When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I was thinking about God, as I think all children do from time to time. And I remember walking down the stairs of our farmhouse, and all of a sudden it just overwhelmed me that, wow, maybe there is a God, and I just don't know that I'm right with Him. And it was so terrifying, so awesome feeling that my legs just buckled and I collapsed on the stairs and had to sit there for a little bit just to recover. I know years later, after I'd come to know Christ, I was with my family in a pop-up camper we used to own, and just trying to go to sleep, thinking about God. And again, that same kind of feeling came over me. Oh my goodness, God really is there. And all that's between us is this thin canvas, you know. And my goodness, I'm just vulnerable before Him. I think all of us have had times like that when we realize, oh my goodness, God is there. And He is so powerful, so strong, so amazing. He could just snuff me out with one little touch of His finger. We have a sense of awe in His presence. And some of that is good. And it's true, it's right that He is the awesome Creator of all and that we are totally vulnerable, defenseless before Him. And there is something that's rightly fearful about that. It's called the fear of God. Today we're going to look at one of the places in the Bible where God reveals Himself in this powerful, awesome, amazing way, I think probably more powerfully than any other place in the Bible. And it's when it's the giving of the Ten Commandments. And I'd like to, we look at our passage in Deuteronomy, I'd like just to set the stage a little bit by looking at Exodus. Exodus 19. It talks about what was happening when God gave the Ten Commandments. It says, on the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. And they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The mountain came down, and the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. I remember one time my wife and I, we were on a canoe trip down the Osable River with some others from our church in East Lansing, Michigan. And we camped next to the river in this little tent, and this really amazing storm came in at night, and just the thunder was booming, and it just felt like the earth itself was shaking. And, you know, I was just terrified there and just felt like, oh boy, I wish I could just dig through the bottom of the tent and dig a hole in the ground just to get away from the power of the thunder and the potential of getting struck by lightning. And that was just, think about what it was like for these folks standing before this mountain and this powerful thunder and lightning. And there's the mountain's on fire because God has touched the mountain, and there's a blackness and smoke billowing up and a trumpet. I don't know what the trumpet comes from. Maybe there was an angel sounding. I don't know. This trumpet gets louder and louder. And the ground is actually quaking, not just from the thunder, but there's earthquakes going on. And God is showing Himself to probably over 3 million people standing there at the foot of the mountain. An amazing revelation of the power of God. And as Moses speaks to God, God responds, and his voice booms out from the mountain, giving us the Ten Commandments. And I'd like to have Jenny come up and read for us our passage today from Deuteronomy chapter 5. And in this passage, Moses is looking back on this event that occurred 40 years earlier before he gives this sermon that he gives to the children of Israel, reminding them of what happened on that day.
Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 1 through 22. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time, to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain. He said, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God commanded you, that your days may be long, and that it may go well with you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder, and you shall not commit adultery, and you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's." These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain out of the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on 2 tablets of stone and gave them to me.
Thank you, Jenny. I don't know if there's any other place that we read that God gave a sermon right out of the mountain to these people. So we're going to go through these Ten Commandments this morning. But first, I'd just like to make some overall observations. One is that these ten are central to the covenant that God was making to Israel. And we see this, I think, because of the way he delivers them, because of the booming voice and all of the fire and all of the smoke and the trembling mountain and the trumpet blast. He was making a point that this is the center of this agreement I'm making with you. This is your responsibility, Israel. I'll be your God, but this is your responsibility. Also, he wrote them on tablets with his own finger, which I think emphasizes it again. This is the center of the covenant. And Moses, as we just read, he said, he added no more. So the implication is there that this is in some way a completion of the summary of the law. There's over 300 commands in the Old Testament law, but this was the center of it. And he said, he added no more. It's a complete summary. And Moses says in Deuteronomy 4:13 that he equates this with the covenant. He equates these Ten Commandments with the covenant. The second point is that this is historical. This is not just some mythology that developed over the centuries. This really happened. God really did this. These people were actually there, and it happened. Now, today in archaeology, some would doubt this, and some would say that during the time that Israel was supposedly in Egypt, there really weren't any Israelites there at all. And I think there's some question about how to line up the timeline in the Bible with the timeline of Egyptian chronology that archaeologists use. But Christian scholars have looked, and they've been able to line it up. And if you match it rightly, there really is evidence that there were Asiatics, people from the area that the Israelites are from, living in Canaan with their customs. In fact, even in some of the houses that they lived in, there are infants buried in the center of the house, in the floor of the house, their houses, which is very unusual for any people to have people buried right in your home. And the percentage of infants that they're finding in these houses is way more than you typically would find in any culture compared to the percentage of adult graves. And so you get the idea here, well, their infants were being killed somehow. Of course, we know that story from the Bible. These people just left, leaving nothing behind. They don't know what happened to them, why they were there, why they left. Right after they left, there was an invading army that came in and conquered Egypt and ruled Egypt for several hundred years. And one of the Egyptian historians says that they conquered the land without a battle. Now that is pretty amazing, that you conquer a land like Egypt without a battle. Well, it could be that the Egyptian army was at the bottom of the Red Sea. So all this really matches up with archaeology and history if you get the timeline right. If you're interested in more on this, there's a book called Unwrapping the Pharaohs that we have on our dining room coffee table. If you ever want to come over and visit, you can take a look at it. It talks about this archaeology, and once again, the Bible is being supported by archaeological evidence that we're finding out there. So it's historical. Thirdly, the order is uncertain. This is kind of an interesting thing, that there are Ten Commandments. We know that because it says that in Deuteronomy 4 and also in Exodus, that there are Ten Commandments. But as you look at the list, there's actually 14 commands, and it's a little hard to know how to divide it into 10. So there's three basic ways. The one is the Jewish way, and this is based on the fact that the Jewish word for the commandments is not commandments, it's words. There are these 10 words. And so the Jews take the first statement, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. It's not a commandment, but it's a statement, it's a word. They say, this is the first word, and then the other nine are the commandments. And so they combine, have no gods before me and no idols. The second way to divide it is the way that a church father, Augustine, divided it. This is popular among Catholics and Lutherans, if you were raised in that either of those traditions. Probably you had this order. Again, no other gods before me and idols are combined, but then at the end, there's a separation between don't covet your neighbor's wife and don't covet anything else from your neighbors. And so that is divided into two commandments. And there's so then the rest of the Protestant world pretty much follows this order right here, and that's what we're going to follow today, since that's what the way we've traditionally, it's really not that important what the order is, but it's just a little interesting factoid. And so it's dividing the first one, you shall have no other gods before me, and then you shall have no idols, as two taking those as two commandments. The fourth point is that the Ten Commandments can be summarized by loving God and your neighbor. If you look at them, the first four in blue there, those are commandments encouraging us to love God. And the ones in green are commandments, the last six are commandments encouraging us to love our neighbor. And as you know, when Jesus was asked this, he quoted the verses, he says, when he was asked, what is the greatest command in the law? And that was one of the issues in his day. Some were saying, well, the greatest commandments, the most important part of the law is the ceremonial law, you know, the food laws and all the different, those types of laws. Now, others were saying the most important part of the law was the sacrificial part, because if we don't have forgiveness, that we don't have anything. Others were saying the most important part of the law was the governmental aspects of the law and how to run the nation. And so when Jesus was asked this, though, what he said was that the center of the law is to love, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And so the Ten Commandments really are a bit of an expansion of those two commandments that Jesus said are the center of the law. The fifth thing is all the commands are relational. They're all relational. If you look at them, they're relating to loving God or they're relating to loving others. And there are a lot of commands in the Old Testament that it's pretty hard to figure out. I don't know how this relates to loving somebody, you know, whether I eat this food or that food or, you know, how to treat leprosy or whatever. You know, it's just I don't know how this is relevant to loving. You can maybe see it in some of them. But these are very clearly just right in the center of teaching us to love. And then finally, they show us what love looks like. In Romans, Paul says that every command is summarized by the command to love your neighbor as yourself. And yet sometimes it's really difficult for us to know how to best love our neighbor, isn't it? And we'll see this as we go and look through the commands. It can be very confusing. What is the best for myself? What is the best for my neighbor? So the law shows us the ways of God and the ways that are good for us and the way to love. So let's just dive in with the first one. No other gods before me. This word before me is actually, if you look at the word in Hebrew, it means like in front of me, in my presence. It's like a physical idea before me. And so a lot of people would translate this as beside me or in addition to me. And that was really the problem that Israel typically had. And God wasn't just saying, look, I'm the greatest God and all these other gods are lesser than me. He isn't saying that. He's saying, I am the only God. And all these are totally false. You shall have no others but me. I'm the only one. And that's repeated over and over again in the Old Testament, the law and the prophets. Now, it talks here, we read about it, that God is a jealous God, so that when Israel gave their hearts to these false gods, he became jealous. And some people have trouble with that God would be jealous. You know, is he kind of egocentric or is he trying to, you know, protect himself or something? I know Oprah Winfrey, she talks about this, how when she was between 27 and 28, she heard a preacher talking about the attributes of God, his magnificence and his omnipotence and his omnipresence and his love. But then he got to the idea that God was jealous, and something about that just, she said, doesn't ring true to her, that a God who loves all would be jealous. I'd just like to mention a couple things about that. First of all, it doesn't say that he's jealous of us. It's not like we have something that he wants, you know, and that you've got something and I don't have it, so I'm jealous of you. But he's jealous for us. He wants us. And when we give ourselves to someone else or to some other God, he's jealous because he wants us. He loves us. You know, when you think about jealousy, sometimes jealousy is wrong and bad, but there is a good jealousy. It's somewhat like anger. You know, anger, we all know that anger can be tremendously destructive. But God has given us anger for a good purpose sometimes. When there's some injustice or something that needs correction, we get that anger stirs us up. I need to do something about this. I need to set a boundary, or I need to try to fix this. And so anger motivates us to correct injustice. So there's a good element of anger. It can get very selfish, but it's not always so. Same thing with jealousy. There's a good element in jealousy. You know, certainly when you're jealous of something that someone else has that belongs to them, that's a sinful jealousy. You're not loving that person. You're wanting what they have for yourself. You're not caring about them. It belongs to them. But if you're jealous because something that belongs to you is being taken, that would be more of a righteous jealousy. You know, if my wife were giving her affection to someone else, that I wouldn't even dream that she would do that, but let's suppose that it would be the case. It would be right for me to be jealous. And that jealousy would motivate me to set a boundary, to maybe talk to her and say, honey, that's not right. You shouldn't be doing this. Your affection is only for me. It would be the loving thing. The jealousy would stir me up to do the loving thing. And the same thing with God. God is the one. In fact, if I didn't do that, what would it show? It would show I didn't care about her. I didn't give a rip whether she goes and off with somebody else or not. I don't care. Just go ahead. I don't love you, I guess. So the same thing with God. He created us. He owns us. He loves us. We belong to him. And when we give ourselves to other gods, jealousy is the right reaction. And it's sometimes accompanied by anger, it talks about. It's a righteous reaction on God's part. He created us for himself. And the reason he's that way is because he wants us. He loves us. He wants us for himself. He wants that relationship and doesn't want to lose us. Okay, the second commandment is no carved images or no idols. Now, I think it's clear to say that this was not forbidding any art at all. It says you shall not make an image of anything in the heavens or anything on the earth. It wasn't forbidding that, because in the temple itself, they made a carved image of a cherubim over top of the temple. And they put them in, they wove them in the fabric of the tabernacle into the walls of the temple. So they did have representations of things on heaven and on earth, and that was okay. But what it's saying is you should not make such an image and bow down to it. You shouldn't make that and worship it. That is forbidden. I think one reason for this is that it's impossible to have an image that fully represents God. Whatever you make an image of, typically it's a person or an animal. It maybe has some aspect of God that's true in that image, but it reduces him. It makes him less than he truly is. It kind of reduces him to that aspect and demeans him. I think also it's clear in the Bible that fallen angels, fallen spirits will inhabit these images and steal the worship that we should be giving to God. So he says, don't make an idol. Thirdly, don't profane God's name. Don't profane his name. The word profane means, or actually it talks about, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, or don't use that name in emptiness without meaning it. And that's what the word profane means. You hear about profanity that comes from this word profane, is to treat something special as common and ordinary. I like to think of my daughter's wedding dress. You know, we bought her a really nice wedding dress, and she was just beautiful in it, and she wore it, and you know, she's only worn that dress one day, just for a few hours. By far the most expensive dress she's ever owned. Afterwards, they cleaned it, they put it in the box, and it's in a safe place. I don't know if they've even looked at it much since then. But it's this special dress, and what would happen if she wore it every day? It would lose its specialness. It would just become common and ordinary. Or, you know, you just think, oh, I'll just take it and wipe off the counter with it, or use it to wash out the toilet or something. You know, that would defile it. It would ruin it. It would just make it ordinary and common, wouldn't it? And so the same thing with God's name. You know, when you say, oh my God, well, you're probably not really calling on the name of God. You're probably just expressing some displeasure. And so you're using his name trivially. Or if you're asking, you know, God curse or God damn, you know, you're calling on God to curse something. I mean, are you really, or is it just an expression of anger? A very strong expression of anger? It's probably the latter. So you're reducing God as though he's not really even there, or his name is not important. And all throughout the scripture, the name of God is associated with the person of God. So when you reduce his name, you're dishonoring him. Again, demeaning him. It says next, to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. And there's a whole lot spoken there about the Sabbath. The Sabbath was the Saturday, and during that day they were to rest. They were to rest, their animals were to rest, their servants were to rest. Everyone was to rest on that day. Now this shows that really the law does help us know what love is, because it would be really easy to think that the most loving thing is for me just to work as hard as I can so that I can provide better for my family, we can have more savings and more security, and that's the loving thing, is just to work, just so we can give more, and just all kinds of reasons you could think of that just working all the time might be the most loving thing. Well, God tells us here it's not. It's not the most loving thing for ourselves. It's not the most loving things for others. He knows that we need rest. We need a day of rest. And if we don't do that, we're not loving as we should, even though we might be confusingly thinking that that is loving. The next one, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment that has a promise that it may be well with you and that you might live long in the land. Honor your father and mother. This is the first of the commandments that's very clearly related to loving your neighbor. The others seem to be more toward loving God. And it's interesting because if you think about it, this is probably the most fundamental foundational relationship that we have with our father and mother. They're the one that brought us into the world. They're the one that raised us. And so if you think about it, if you're not able to honor your father and mother and love them and respect them, how will you be able to do so with anyone else? The word honor means to prize, to value, to respect, to even to venerate. It's to speak well of them, to care about them in old age. And all that's wrapped up in this honoring your father and mother. Love them. That's where it starts. It's kind of the foundational relationship. He says, you shall not murder, number six. Now, the Hebrew word for murder here can mean both either to murder or to kill. They have one word that covers both of those. In English, we have two separate words. But I think the translators here do rightly to translate this as thou shalt not murder. Because in other places in the Bible and the law, it's very clear that a murderer is to be put to death, or someone who creates does certain heinous crimes is to be put to death. And so the implication, the idea here is that an innocent, don't put to death an innocent person. Only God has the right to put to death an innocent person. Now you might say, well, this one is so obvious, no one would even question that, you know. Why do we need this commandment? Well, if you look at history, it's not been so obvious, has it? I mean, it's often seemed quite loving to kill members of that other tribe. Maybe even to take all their goods so that I can love people around us and we can have more. I mean, that's been very common in history, even in modern times. With the rise of evolution, there was the science of eugenics, where certain people should either be sterilized or even killed because they're just genetically defective, and that's helping evolution along, I guess. This really came to fruition in Nazi Germany, where the eugenicists really got their way, and they put people that were mentally handicapped or handicapped in other ways, they just killed them. They put them in gas chambers. And, of course, even a whole group of people that they thought were defective, the Jews, they put them in gas chambers. 6 million of them were killed during that time. But even here in the United States, there were people who were put to death because there were institutions and handicapped people were injected with tuberculosis, thinking, well, the strongest will survive. 40% of them died in some hospitals, in some places, or some were actually left to starve to death, just because of this idea. It just seemed like it's the best to kill these people. They just don't have much value. So we really do need the revelation of God to know what love looks like, even in something as seemingly heinous as killing. We can really get confused on this stuff. No adultery. You should not commit adultery. This is, the murder was protecting the right to life. This is protecting the right to an exclusive romantic and sexual relationship. God gives us that right in marriage, and it's supporting His plan in marriage that we see back in Genesis, that God called one man and one woman to join together for life, to be married for life, to raise a family. And that's His plan. Now again, you might think, well, this is kind of obvious, but it really isn't that obvious anymore, is it? We don't really know what God's plan is anymore. And so, and if you think about it, well, how do we know this is the best way, one man and one woman for life? How do we know that? I mean, maybe it would be better if we just all lived in communes and just everyone gave one another sexual favors, and just whatever children were born, we just raised them together and we wouldn't know who the father was, but that's no big deal. We'll just, you know, how do we know that isn't the best way to do it? Or how do we know that two men marrying each other and having relationship, or two women having relationships with one another, physical, sexual relationships, how do we know that isn't just as loving, just as kind as a man and a woman united together for life? Well, God tells us. He says, you shall not commit adultery, and it's in the context of this one man, one woman for life that is established in the Scripture. We need this revelation from God to tell us what is right, to tell us what love really looks like, because We can try things out, as been the case with the whole sexual revolution in my generation growing up, and it continues. It's, we'll try this out. Tremendous devastation, just tremendous destruction in relationships and cultural problems and pain. Many of us today, here today, are from divorced families. And, you know, being a care minister, I know some of the pain that goes with that, being a child of divorce. There's a lot of pain that has come because we haven't really followed this command, you shall not commit adultery. A lot of blessing that's been lost. You shall not steal. Again, this one might seem obvious, but what does this support? It supports the right to hold private property. No one should steal what's yours. You have a right to it. Not even the government should take what is yours. You have the right to it. And of course, this really is the foundation of freedom. There's something in my life that I have control over that the government doesn't have a right to tell me what to do about it. I have the freedom to do what I want with what is mine. It's the right to private property. And of course, that's also been really confused. There's been millions of people in our generation that followed Marx and Lenin and the whole communist idea that it's better that we don't have private property. Let's just hold everything in common. That's the most loving thing to do. To the human mind, it might seem that way. How do we know? Well, God says, you shall not steal. He gives that right, and it's a right that needs to be protected. Throughout the history of the church, this commandment, and even in Israel, this commandment has often been applied to stealing of people, kidnapping someone and selling them into slavery or making them your slave. So it has application as well to slavery. You know, even here, it's a really sad thing in our country that there really have been arguments that are pro-slavery, that it really is the most, slavery is really the most loving thing. And some of this has been actually in Christian circles in the South and so forth. Slavery is the most loving thing because there's some people, they just really aren't able to lead themselves. They aren't able to provide for themselves. They just don't have the wherewithal. They're just kind of inferior. And so it's better that they be slaves, and that way they're protected and cared for and so forth. I mean, it's embarrassing to even think that that has been part of our nation's heritage, but it has been. But how do we know that's not right? Well, because God says you shall not steal, and that includes stealing a person's liberty and taking them as a slave. That's really forbidden in this commandment. And then finally, it says, or number nine, it says, don't bear false witness. What is this protecting? This is protecting the right to have a good reputation. And here it's certainly talking about not bearing false witness in a court of law, but it's much broader than that also. It's not speaking evil of your neighbor, not slandering, not gossiping, not saying things against the other one, because we need love is protecting that person's reputation. It's thinking the best of them and speaking the best of them. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. And then finally, number 10, it's don't covet. Now, this one is really interesting because it takes some of these other commandments that we've already talked about, and it's taken it from outward action into the heart. For example, the seventh commandment, no adultery. It says, don't covet your neighbor's wife. It's not enough just to stay away from your neighbor physically, but don't even in your heart desire her. That's not loving. God is interested not just in outward love and outward actions. He wants us to grow in learning to love from the heart, because he is love, and he wants his creatures to also love. And so he says, don't commit adultery even in your heart, or stealing. Don't even covet your neighbor's property. You're, you know, in your heart wanting to steal that. No, rejoice that your neighbor has that. Be glad for him. That's what love looks like. And I think it also applies to, as Jesus applied it, to murder. You know, don't, if you're angry with your brother or in your heart, you despise him. It's similar to murder, and the same thing with not bearing false witness. You know, if you're thinking thoughts towards someone that are evil and are tearing them down and not thinking the best of them, it's really in your heart you're violating the ninth commandment. So interestingly, God takes, even in the Old Testament, he was concerned not just for outward actions, he was concerned for the heart. So how does all this apply to us today? How do we apply this in the new covenant? We are not under the old covenant. We saw that these Ten Commandments are the essence of the covenant that God made with Israel. It's the center, the summary of what they were to do. How does that apply to us in the new covenant? Well, one thing to say is that all of these commandments, except for possibly one, all of these commandments are repeated in the New Testament. We are enjoined to do all these things in the new covenant. The one that's not repeated is the Sabbath. And there's a lot of argument, and there's some argument amongst Christians and on whether we're required to keep the Sabbath or not. But I think most likely it says in Galatians and other places that we don't consider one day above another or one day more important than the other, or we can have freedom of conscience as to Sabbath days. So I think it's probably not repeated. It was also a commandment that was associated with Israel being taken out of Egypt. And so, but I think that even there, by the way, even there, the principle that we need one day out of seven for rest, I think still applies, even if we're not under that command that you have to rest on Saturday. If we're not under that command legalistically, we are under it in principle. And it teaches us something, that it's better to have rest than to just keep working, working, working. That's not as loving as taking time to rest. Both for you, for your family, for your employees, for just for everyone. Secondly, when we think about the Old Testament law as a whole, this was the center of it. We are not under that covenant, we're under a new covenant, but it doesn't mean we can't learn things about how to love from the old covenant. I would think of it like this. We are under the laws of Iowa and the laws of the United States of America. But you could study the laws of Britain or the laws of France. Even though we're not under that law, you could study those laws and you could find out a lot about what it means to be a good citizen, how you should respect and honor your leaders, and there'd be a lot of good things you could learn from another law that you aren't under. And I think that's the way we should look at the Old Testament law. There's a tremendous amount of instruction, a tremendous amount of examples here that do show us what love looks like. And the New Testament authors often draw on the Old Testament for this purpose of showing what love looks like, even though we're not actually under that command, under that covenant. And again, nine out of the 10 of them are repeated in the new covenant, which is understandable. God, there's a new covenant. There's many different things about it. But the core of God's ways for that nation and the core of what he wants for the church, you would expect to be the same because it's the same God and he has the same ways at the core of things. I'd just like to close off here by looking at a passage in Hebrews. And the author of Hebrews is looking back on the same passage that we were just reading and studying. And he's comparing what happened on that day with these 3 million people before the mountain. What happened there? He's comparing that with what is true for us under the new covenant. And he's basically saying there are some differences, but what's happening to us is even more awesome than what happened to them. And we'll read here and see why that's the case. Hebrews 12:18 says, "For you have not come to what may be touched." We haven't come to a physical mountains, a blazing fire, and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. They were so terrifying to them. But rather, you have come to Mount Zion, into the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. The mountain we've come to is even greater, the heavenly Jerusalem. And to innumerable angels in festal gathering. There's something about the new covenant. I think there's more of a joyful attitude in that forgiveness is complete in the work of Christ. And the angels are filled with joy. Innumerable angels, that we've come to these angels who are celebrating, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. Evidently, that's those who have gotten there before us, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood, that be the death of Jesus, that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The work of Jesus is better than all the sin that's ever been committed in the world. It's able to undo it. This is what we've come to. So he exhorts us. He says, see that you do not refuse him who is speaking. And in this case, these people, they were turning away from Christianity. They were turning back to Judaism. And they were refusing the faith, rejecting the faith. And it says, for if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. And he says, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. We haven't seen this experience, but by eyes of faith, we can imagine it. The heavenly Jerusalem that we've come to is similar to the way that happened under the first covenant. We need to respect who Jesus is and what he did and the commands that he gives and give our lives to him, just as he asked them to do that in the first covenant. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your word. We just acknowledge to you, Lord, it's so many things that we just couldn't figure out if we didn't have your revelation. We would be so confused, just like the world around us is confused. There'd be so many things that would actually, where we think that we're loving and we think that we're kind and we think we're doing the right thing when we're actually destructive and harmful. Thank you for your word. It's like the guide rails in the side of a mountain road, not put there to restrict us, but to protect us. Help us to know that everything that you say is good, that you know what you're talking about. You're the creator. Help us to remember that we're designed for you, and that when we don't give our lives and hearts for you, you are jealous. You want us. You love us. Help us not to turn to other things. And we thank you for your word, and we thank you for these Ten Commandments. Help us, Lord, to follow them as best we can. Thank you that when we fail, when we stumble, there is forgiveness in Jesus Christ, and we have that blood of Christ that speaks better than the blood of Abel. It's able to cover over our sins. And we thank you for these things in Jesus' name.